We're so close to the Pentagon. Sometimes they ask us to get the coffee. This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the all-new Warbird Radio Live channel. We're happy to be back on the air right across from the runway at Washington Reagan International Airport. Be sure and tune in Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern each week for Warbird Radio Live, followed by a new episode of one of our top-tier shows like the R.C. Scale Builder Show, Hartman and Hines, Over the Front, and the all-new Texas Warbird Report and Wings Over New Zealand Show. Listen, this station is all about community, so please join up with us on Tuesday nights and call in and become part of the fun and part of the family. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Hello, welcome to the Wings Over New Zealand live show for March 2016 here on Warbird Radio. I'm your host, Dave Homewood. It's been a while since the show's been on air. We haven't had one this year. This is the first for 2016, so it's great to be back. Thanks very much to Matt and all the team at Warbird Radio. It's great to be back. Unfortunately, this month, my co-host, Grant McHerrin, is unable to join us due to a work commitment. So this episode, I'm going to be logging a bit of solo time on the show. I also have to warn listeners that I've not long finished a long night shift. So if you suddenly hear snoring rather than talking, I do apologize. We have to get Matt to blow a whistle or something and wake me up. It's been a very busy week here in New Zealand for me, particularly, as I mentioned earlier on Matt's show, we've had a big event over the weekend. The Wings Over New Zealand Forum Meet, which is a semi-regular meetups of the members of our forum. The Wings Over New Zealand Aviation Forum, for those who don't know, is New Zealand's largest aviation website. And I run that. I own it. And we have about 4,500 members, almost 4,500 members. And every now and then we'll have some sort of get-together around New Zealand, and members come along and we get some guest speakers and everybody has a good time talking aeroplanes and looking at aeroplanes and that sort of thing. And it's always a fun event. And this particular one was a two-day event that we held in Auckland. The first day was at Don Zabritsky's private collection, which is an amazing collection of old, mainly World War II aeroplanes that served in the Royal New Zealand Air Force. Although he's got a few post-war things there, including a Meteor jet, all stored away in his sheds. And he kindly this is the third time we've been to his place for a meet. He kindly allows us to go in there and clamber all over his aeroplanes and have a look through and take photos, and then we'll have a few guest speakers. And it's great fun. And Don's a real good character. He's one of aviation's true gentlemen, and he's a really neat guy. The second day we had it at New Zealand Warbirds Association's hangar at Ardmore Airport, just south of Auckland. And the Warbirds guys are just fantastic as well. They're really accommodating, and, you know, we get to, you know, take over their hangar for a day, and it's great. We had some good speakers there too. So, you know, as well as Don Zabritsky speaking on the weekend, we had a few people like Rick Martini, who talked about his father, who was a U.S. Army Air Force B-17 waste gunner that was shot down, captured, and ended up in the Buchenwald death camp, unfortunately, sent there by the Gestapo. And him and a couple of hundred other airmen who were sent there by the Gestapo ended up being saved by the persistence of a New Zealand squadron leader called Phil Lamison, DFC. And so that was a great story. And we had a couple of Corsair pilots, RNZAF Corsair pilots, Frank Culliford and Brian Cox speaking. We had Gavin Grimmer talking about a lost Tiger Moth. We had Ron Wilson talking about the restoration of the Short Sunderland at MOTAT, which is an Auckland museum. Dennis Lawton spoke about his work on parts of a Handley Page Hastings, and that's at the same museum, MOTAT. Jonathan Pote talked about a visit of a Vulcan, Avro Vulcan, to New Zealand back in 1959. And we had well-known airshow display pilot Doug Brooker, who talked about his flying career. his aerobatics and his lovely Supermarine Spitfire, which we'll hear a little bit more about later on. We also had a former RNZAF navigator, Mick Murray, who he talked about his days flying RNZAF Canberras, flying in them, in Southeast Asia in the 1960s during the Malayan emergency and over Borneo and places like that. Just amazing. And we capped it all off at the end with Warren Denham of Avspex talking about taking the Mosquito KA114 to Air Venture at Oshkosh last year, where they won the top award for the restoration. That was a really great event. But one of the speakers that I haven't mentioned yet was Dick Lambert, who was a Royal Air Force pilot in the 1950s. He actually joined in 1943. And he was flying Lancasters and Lincolns, the big old four-engine bombers, in the 1950s, when he was drafted in to fly an Avro Lancaster bomber as part of the filming of the world-famous 1954 feature film, The Dam Busters. So here's a recording of that talk, which Dick gave on Saturday.
And Dave, it's coming up here right now. Stand by.
I'm Dick Lambert, and my claim to fame is that I flew in the Dam Busters. I joined the Air Force, well, the raid was in May 1943, and I joined the Air Force in June 43. I didn't know then that I would meet the Dam Busters about 15 years later. Anyway, I was eventually called up, and after the initial training, of course, I conflicted with the D-Day landings, and as the Air Force didn't have so many casualties as they expected, a lot of us were made redundant, and I became a flight engineer for a little while. I became redundant again, became a flight mechanic, and that's where the story picks up with my time in the Air Force. But around about 1945, I think it must have been, I guess are there many service people here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know what a pay parade was like. It's usual chaos. You march up to the table, salute, pick up your money and disappear. Well, I picked up my money and after lunch went back to the billet and counted my money. I realised I'd been overpaid. Well, what do I do? Do I put it in my pocket? Or do I go and see somebody about it? Anyway, my conscience got the better of me. I went to see the paying officer, who was delighted to see me, and handshakes all round. And he then said, well, I'll take you into the group captain, as you're such an honest young airman. So I went and had a chat with the group captain for quite a long time, bearing in mind I was redundant. And but I had signed on for 3 years as a flight mechanic, but I did hope to resume training one day, but of course that seemed to be very unlikely at the time. So suddenly he said, what can I do for you? And I said, well, I want to go back to flying. And within 6 weeks I was on a refresher course, and that's where I went on to, with my flight mechanic working, went to 46MU up at Lossiemouth. And on the MU was a lot of aircraft in long-term storage, and one of them was a Dam Buster. So I took a lot of pictures of that, which I've subsequently lost, unfortunately. And, well, okay, then that was 1940, what did I say, about 1950-odd. I finally went back to flying training, and my first squadron was 101 Squadron, which was, if anybody would know the history of radio countermeasures, was a squadron that had fantastic casualties because the Germans could home onto all the radio countermeasures. later on, I was on 97 Squadron, and I went on leave one day, came back, and there on the airfield at Hemswell, there was four Lancasters. I thought, well, I'd like to fly one of those. And of course, I was lucky enough to fly in the film, The Dam Busters, which became quite a good, popular, well-known film. And about the film, we flew all the raids, or all the flying training areas, like Windermere and Derwent Water and all those sort of places. We actually did the film, the circuits, as it was. We used the same briefing rooms, the same style. Everything was as was the real thing. The only thing was that, of course, we didn't get shot at. The aeroplane I represented was Mickey Martin, who was an Australian, and I believe he became a very senior officer in Australia, in the Australian Air Force. Mickey Martin was represented by Bill Kerr, who had a fantastic range of very rude jokes. Anybody want to ask any questions about the Lancaster and so on?
Well, the low-level flying that you were doing in the film, was that quite different from what you were normally doing on Squadron?
Oh, yes. We were at high-level bombing, and that was at 20,000-odd feet. And getting a Lancaster as a young pilot, there's a Lancaster, go and fly it. And by the way, do some low flying. And of course, that was the way it went. And flying over Derwent Water, there was a good picture of me actually, a little bit lower than the raid, which was ended up at I think 60 feet, was it? Anyway, at that height, the water gets a bit ruffled by the propellers. So they didn't use that shot.
So how much flying did you do for the film, if you can remember?
Well, what they actually used wasn't very much. We did quite a lot of flying around, positioning and so on, you know, taxiing shots and that sort of thing. If they'd had telephones, they could have communicated with the people on the ground. The flying shots over Derwent Water... in England, most of you will know the Lake Windermere and places like that in England. Well, Derwent Water near Sheffield has got two towers exactly the same as the raid or the Mona Dam. They had the AA there to say what the weather was like and, you know, okay, come and fly. So they were never really tuned up. They wasted a lot of space in filming there. Right. Yeah.
What were the cameras they used? Because the cameras back in those days were big, huge lens with big round.
Well, that's right. Yes.
So what did they had aircraft to film?
Well, they had the four Lancasters. They had a Wellington, and they used a Mosquito once or twice because they actually did in the film, and they had they took the doors off of Varsity. And maybe the chaps were just leaning out of the side. It wasn't ideal. Incidentally, on that, the Varsity Hercules engines spew out a lot of oil. And I was right behind it one night when they did the searchlight shots, and I realized I couldn't see. And there's a place called Langham. It's a disused airfield. This was at night, so I landed there and missed a lot of haystacks, and my engineer got out and cleaned the windscreen. We took off again and went back and joined the film. Yeah. I'm told we upset some poachers.
When you were coming across the vans, what speed were you going at? And you told me before, but I forget.
What did I tell you? I can't remember. It would have been, well, probably in miles an hour or whatnot, but it would have been a couple of hundred, I suppose, 200.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we've actually measured the distance now between the tip of your propellers and the top of the dam when you went through there on that picture.
Yeah.
It was 23 feet.
Yeah,
so
it was low. With that, the one that they actually used in the film was don't forget there was other pilots, not just me, but on this particular one, I did it really low, but there wasn't any real direction of what they wanted to do. You know, there's a film, well, in the raid, Gibson formated above Martin to distract the AK-AK. Well, they could have easily shown that if they wanted to, but they didn't. But anyway, and then there was when Maudsley was actually shot down, I thought, well, I'll do it anyway. So that's why I was low, and then I dived down and then climbed up, and as you can see in the film with me coming up, that's supposed to represent when he crashed, and he was talking, I'm okay, but he wasn't. So there was a lot of waste of time.
Do you see your actual face in the film?
No. As I say, I was with supposed to be Martin,
yeah.
And Bill Kerr is an Australian, of course, too, and he was quite funny to work with. But he would sit in the cockpit, and my engineer would start up the engines, and which takes it out of the way. Later on, Richard Todd actually did do a bit of taxiing.
Did they modify the four aircraft that you used for filming with the bomb doors gone?
No, they did. They did three. They took the doors off the three of them and put that big bump on, which was far too big for the... I mean, if you know it, the bomb almost fits into the bomb bay, but it did stick out a bit.
They removed the mid-upper too, didn't they?
Pardon?
Did they not remove the mid-upper turret as well?
That's right, yes. They took the mid-upper turret
and
away.
And
they used the hydraulics and services for rotating the bomb.
Dick, there is another link with New Zealand on the aircraft you flew, because Nicky Martin's rear gunner was a chap called Lynn Chambers.
Oh, yes.
And Lynn is sort of the golden man of the Van Busters Raiders as far as Kiwis are concerned. So he was drafted in from 75 Squadron.
Yes.
To become Nicky Martin's rear gunner. And he only did another raid or two after that, on 617.
Well, you know that most of the crews of 617 were wiped out a few months later,
yeah,
on a raid over the Kiel Canal.
Yeah.
Have you been back to Kentwood?
No, I haven't. Lately? No.
Last year, they had one of the bombs sitting there, the casings of it.
Oh, yes. Yes. I have seen it. They rescued one from Chisel Beach or somewhere, and I've seen it in Duxford or Cosford, one of the two. Yeah, it's not that big, but...
They had a big scare last year, and in the memorial, the front face of it fell off.
Really?
About a couple of weeks before some big ceremony.
So okay.
They thought it was some kind of terrorist act, but apparently the concrete had given way and it just slid off.
There was, there's a new memorial to Bomber Command.
I was there for the opening.
Were you? No, I got the invitation, but I decided against going. Yeah. My wireless operator, Bill French, he came out here just recently and said I missed a big party in Derwent Water, whatever. There's a plaque or something went up.
I think when V for Vera was over there last September, the pair of the Lancasters flew over a lot of those sites.
Yes.
It was well documented.
It was a shame that they had four perfectly good Lancasters, and it was at the time when these things should have been going into museums, but after the film they took him to bits and
During the filming, did you meet any of the actual Dam Buster guys from the raid?
Well, yes, I've got a picture of and I can't think of the chap's name now. I've got a picture of Michael Redgrave, Richard Todd, and the station commander at the time, and they're all sitting down watching that final bit when he's saying, "I'm very sorry about all the blokes that were killed." Group Captain Warfield, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's the only one that I met. And of course, he was only the station commander.
Right.
Yeah.
What about Barnes Wallace?
He was supposed to be Michael Redgrave. But some time ago, they upgraded the film digitalized it or whatever. And I went down to London to see that, and I met Mrs. Barnes Wallace, or whatever her name was. He wasn't there because he's dead.
Yeah.
And some of the others, yeah. That was quite nice. Yeah.
Have you been asked to help with the this prospective movie with workshops and?
Well, yeah, they did contact me and say I was a survivor or something like that. And what can you do with the film? The Dam Buster film was really like a documentary. I mean, apart from the fact you didn't know exactly what the bloke said, it was identical to my way of life in the Air Force, which incidentally I was never operational. But that way, when they'd come back from the raid, they came in, flopped on the bed and said, you know, what the hell, picked up their laundry. But it was, you know, it was so odd. What can you do? You could add a bit of sex in it and so on. But what can you do? It's a documentary. Pardon?
I think it's a Titanic movie, you know, they build it around a relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
There must be a lot of footage that was taken of making of the movie.
Oh,
is that around somewhere?
Absolutely. Well, when I went down to London, that was in the film archives. So that would be on the south bank of the Thames, near Westminster Bridge. Yeah, there would be tons. Well, one of to make up the show, they showed all some of the early experiments that Barnes Wallace was doing. Mm. And it was really hit and miss, you know. It's first of all, he wanted to be up 120 feet, and it didn't work. Come down a bit more. I mean, we can all start that.
Chicken, after the movie, what did you go back to fly?
Well, even during the moving, the Cold War was on, so I was flying Lancasters at the time, Lincolns rather, so they would do an exercise with using Lincolns, and I'd be on that, and then, you know, like, too late to fly for the film company. So, yeah, so I went back to normal flying.
The other guys on the Lancaster crews, were they all from your squadron?
No, I was on 97 Squadron. And 83 Squadron was also providing pilots. Yeah.
When you guys talked amongst each other, you know, during the filming on set or whatever, were you guys feeling, you know, pretty privileged to be doing this, or did you just think it was another job?
No, just another job. The big privilege was T-bone steaks at lunchtime. Because, as I said, it was the Cold War was on, Britain was still suffering rationing, and they had an on-site caravan. So we went down to Scampton, where the real raid took off. And incidentally, Nigger's grave is still there. So at lunchtime, they'd break, and we'd all have fantastic lunches. I don't know where the meat came from. I know where it went.
Dick, was the Nigger thing big then, or has it just been blown all out of stupid proportion these days? The name of using the word nigger for the dog.
Oh, yes.
And they all called it that, renaming it, and they can't do it in America because of this.
Yeah, no, I honestly don't know. I can imagine it was pretty emotional. I mean, Gibson was quite a chap, and his dog would have... I mean, it was emotional, there's no doubt about it. And, of course, the grave was right on the edge of the perimeter track, and now they've got a wrought iron fence around it. So it's really like a monument to 617 Squadron. Oh, there's one other thing, that, of course, the raid was at night, as you know, so in those days the technology for making films dark didn't exist, so it was all a bit hit and miss. And we were doing that crowd scene outside the hangar when everybody's got their Mae West on and so on, just kicking around waiting, and they'd got some footage on, And a meteor taxis in, which upset the film. I had to do it all over again.
Well, actually, what did you train in? Were you in the Anson's or?
Well, I'll tell you a story. What was the story now?
Jordan Club.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. I've been redundant so many times that you can say whatever you like. I first trained on Tiger Moss and Harvard's, and then when I became redundant and retrained under the pilot navigator bomb aimer system, I then trained on a thing called a Provost, I think it was. That had a cartridge starter. And at a dining in night, we're pulling somebody's leg, and to get it started, you pull on a lever. And there was a poem where you pull on the wire, the pulls are a bloody great bang, and the engine's on fire. But that was, so that was that. And then I went on to Wellington's, and then Lancaster's, and then I was shipped off to fly B-29s for a little while, Washington's, and then I went back to Lincoln's. And then I went to, I was grounded for a little while as a station adjutant, which was fun. And I then went to Thornley Island on the south coast to fly Vampires. I hear the Vampires, or the Night Fighter version. We were training Night Fighter navigators. And then they got the NF-14 Meteor, which was fun. That's because, they were brand new, because the... What was that triangular thing? Javelin. Javelins came on stream too early. Well, earlier. And a lot of these things would have been refurbished, brand new. And they were lovely to fly. And then, I left the Air Force then.
Did you ever get into trouble? Were there any funny stories?
When we went over Derwent Water, Martin's aeroplane was on the starboard side, Gibson's supposed to be in the front, and somebody else on the left hand. So as we climbed up, I lost sight of the leader, and his tail came up sort of into view, and I pulled up, but I lost sight of him. I was too high, and he climbed up. That was frightening. That was when the chap was writing in about his chickens laying pregnant eggs or something.
Dick, you flew Lancaster and Lincoln.
Yeah.
What was your thoughts of the Lincoln and the differences from flying the Lancaster?
Well, to actually fly them, there's very little difference. They were bigger. They had a bigger wingspan by about 20 feet. They were designed to come out here for the Pacific War, which was fortunately not there. And
these, a lot of them are Malaya. I mean, the Australians...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we were with the Australians and to Changi or somewhere. I went out there to supply the Cocos Islands with the London to Melbourne air race. So I met the Australians there. They were bombing the bandits just up country. But the Lincoln was a good aeroplane, pretty ugly with that bomb aimer's window, but. They had two-speed superchargers, and you could go up to 30,000 feet. And, we lost an aeroplane to a MiG fighter on its way to Berlin for an exercise. So the Cold War was not really nice.
Did any Lancasters ever get to Southeast Asia? Because... some years ago, I was speaking to a 75 squadron chap, World War II, in Australia, and he hitched a lift coming home.
Oh, yeah.
And they were sending Lancs out to the Southeast Asia before the end of the war to see how they coped in the hot weather.
Yeah. So well, there was I think they made up a thing called Tiger Force, and a lot of Lancasters were painted white in anticipation of coming out here. But, it was a time of change. A lot of things happened and didn't happen and that sort of thing. Yeah, but there was Lancasters out here.
I just wondered how they coped operationally compared to the Lincoln had different engines, didn't it?
Yeah, they had, they had these two-speed superchargers and two-stage. And, the serviceability was fantastic, really. I mean, you could... There was no really trouble. So if they came out here for tropical trials, I'm sure they would have had no problems with them. I'll pass these two big pictures. Pass those around.
Yeah.
That's me as a boy.
All right. How did they put the damage on the wing? Is that fabric?
No, it's just a sheet of aluminium with somebody chopped it up around,
right,
and then riveted on. We didn't fly with that on. It just came in to when Harris and Cochrane were coming to meet the crews.
Okay.
You all realise that Richard Todd was a parachute officer, one that landed on D-Day on the French coast, so here he was, a hero playing a hero.
Yeah.
He had a big Rolls Royce that he used to muck about with on the Perry track when we weren't flying.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dick. Okay. It's been fascinating to listen. Well, that was a wee taste of the forum meet with the type of speakers that we had on the weekend, and the questions from the floor that were coming up there were from Zach Yates, Peter Wheeler, Glenn Turner, Peter Lewis, and myself. And the photo just mentioned at the end with the damage on the wing of the Lancaster, I've sent that photo through to Matt, and he'll put it up on the show notes later. And my thanks to Stu Russell too, who filmed this and other presentations at the event, and those films, including Dick Lambert, that's will end up on the Wings Over New Zealand forum eventually, so you can actually watch them. We'll be back after the break with some Warbird news from around New Zealand, and we'll also hear from Warren Denham of AvSpecs talking about the latest restorations that they're working on.
We're so close to the Pentagon, sometimes they ask us to get the coffee. This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the all-new Warbird Radio Live channel. We're happy to be back on the air right across from the runway at Washington Reagan International Airport. Be sure and tune in Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern each week for Warbird Radio Live, followed by a new episode of one of our top-tier shows like the R.C. Scale Builder Show, Hartman and Hines, Over the Front, and the all-new Texas Warbird Report and Wings Over New Zealand Show. Listen, this station is all about community, so please join up with us on Tuesday nights and call in and become part of the fun and part of the family. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Welcome back to the Wings Over New Zealand live show on Warbird Radio. I'm your host, Dave Homewood. In the news roundup of all things Warbird and Classic around New Zealand, I'm very pleased to report that that New Zealand's very own PBY Catalina flying boat is once again airborne following a four-year restoration program to repair its wings. The Catalina, which listeners will recall was detailed on a Wings Over New Zealand live show last year, took flight again just before the weekend, and it's been doing several shakedown flights since, including up to Lake Taupo. So that's fantastic to see that back in the air, and it's a real classic of the New Zealand air show scene. It's much loved, and it's got a shiny new paint scheme, and it's hopefully going to return to its air show duties in less than 2 weeks' time at the Warbirds Over Wanaka air show. Also, another milestone was reached just last month. We missed the show last month, so we didn't get that news out. And that's the completion of a 16-year restoration of a rear Airspeed Oxford twin-engine trainer aircraft from World War II at the Air Force Museum of New Zealand in Christchurch. And that was rolled out to the public back in February. It just looks absolutely stunning from the photos I've seen. I can't wait to get down and see it in its completed state. I've seen it several times during those 16 years when it was being restored, and what a magnificent job they've been doing. It's a very important type in RNZF history. Most of our bomber pilots, our Catalina pilots, our Sunderland pilots, Dakota pilots, all those guys learned to fly on the Airspeed Oxford. So, just an amazing aircraft, and they've done a great restoration on it. Just coming up in the next couple of weeks, on March the 20th, there's a Omaka flying day at Marlborough's historic Omaka Aerodrome, which that aerodrome is the South Island's Flying Warbirds hub. So if you're in the top of the South Island, get along to Omaka's flying day on March the 20th.
And then the big air show of the year for New Zealand happens at Easter, 25th to the 27th of March, and that's the Warbirds over Wanaka air show, the famous air show that happens down at Wanaka in Otago. And as well as having the Catalina return to the air show scene there, they've got quite a few other things that are happening, including a NASA balloon launch. And really interesting for the Warbird fans is a Messerschmitt 109, or at least a Spanish-built Hispano Bouchon, is coming out from England just for the show, and that's going to be displayed by John Romain, who's an absolutely awesome pilot. I saw him last year at Masterton flying the P-40, and he's a stunning pilot. And with Wings Over New Zealand news, the Wings Over New Zealand show podcast is just about to produce its 100th episode. Now, this isn't the live show. We've done 12 shows. Well, this is the 12th show of the live show, but this is the podcast, which can be downloaded off the internet. We're just about to do the 100th show, and I'm really pleased to say that I'm working with Grant McHeron, my co-host on this show, to put together something for that. And it will be out hopefully in the next few weeks. So keep an eye out for that. It's going to be quite a special show, I hope. And to cap off the news, here's a clip from Warren Denham from his talk on Sunday at the Forum Meet in Auckland. And he's updating everybody on the latest happenings with the restorations at Avspecs Limited at Ardmore.
Just a quick update on what's going on over in the hangar at the moment. We've got two more mosquitoes on the go at the moment. We've got a dual control one. Plan is to have it flying in August this year. It's going to go and live in Seattle when it's finished at the Flying Heritage Collection at the big airfield where they build the Boeing at Everett, north of Seattle. And then we've got another one coming on after that, which is an FB6, same as this aeroplane, only the British-built one. That's a Canadian one. That's going to go to the same place that the Tomahawk and the Spitfire that we've restored previously live in San Antonio in Texas, and he also now owns the Dragon Rapide that we restored here as well. You may have seen that at some point. So it's going to go and live in San Antonio in Texas, and it's interesting history because it was an ex-Kiwi one. So of all the mosquitoes that came down to New Zealand, only one of them made its way back to the United States and then got abandoned and ultimately acquired by a collector, and we managed to get it off him and sell it to the guy in Texas. So an ex-New Zealand mosquito has come back to Ardmore, and we're rebuilding that. And that one will be flying in next year, and maybe we can keep it here long enough to go to Wanaka in 2018. But don't tell anybody where you heard that. The fuselage is finished and over at work waiting to get fabric covered. The wing is about 2 months away from being finished. The top skins are all on and the bottom skins are going on now. So, yeah, the airframe's pretty well built. The fin and the horizontal are done. Yeah. So the easy bit's nearly finished.
A question from the floor, which was not picked up by the microphone, was a few months ago, the Biggin Hill Heritage Hangar in the UK announced that they were doing a deal to have a mosquito rebuilt in New Zealand. Warren was asked if he could talk more about that.
Yeah, well, I'm not too sure myself exactly what's going on there. It did look like it was all go, and then it's all gone very quiet. So I don't know whether it's because the aftermath of that Hunter crash has had quite an impact, I think, on the sort of general airshow feeling over there. And it may be that they're kind of just treading on the spot for a while just to see how things go, because a big part of what they thought they could do with the mosquito was go to a whole lot of air shows, and the 2016 air show season in the UK has been cut in half, more or less. So maybe they were waiting, I don't know. I really don't know. I'd like to think that it was going to go ahead, but now I'm very kind of iffy about it, with them anyway. There are other people that are interested in the UK as well. It's just a matter of, you know, finding somebody that's actually prepared to commit themselves for the period of time that it takes. That's probably the worst part of it. I mean, if we could build one and then just say, righto, it's ready, come and get it, you know, you could probably sell half a dozen of them to the UK. But you've got to get someone involved, and then they have to have the confidence that, you know, you're not going to go under in the next 5 years or whatever it takes, and that they're not going to have an issue, and So it's a difficult you know, program to get involved in, because it takes so long. That's the worst part of it, I would say. From the worst thing from their perspective is, do I really want to wait that long, you know? But while they procrastinate, of course, we could be building it. So we've got the two Mosquitoes, and we've got a Mark 16 Spitfire that's on the go as well at the moment for a guy in California. It's been on the go for a long time. But it's sort of coming together now, and in the next 12 months it'll be on its wheels and start looking good. The engine's more or less finished for that one. And then I guess it'll fly in 2018 as well, if we can get some radiators for it. So, yeah, there's plenty on at the moment, but like always, you know, you try and look 3 or 4 years down the track, and, you know, it's not like there's an order book full of orders, but always something seems to come along. The Widgeon. Well, it did have a bit of a burst of activity on the Widgeon a few months ago, so we've got the back end all built up now, ready to go. You know, basically it's just on the shelf, and so it's just a matter of finding the next chunk to put through the process. There's not a lot of the Widgeon airframe that's worth keeping, unfortunately. It's very badly corroded and very badly repaired. So even though it looked quite intact when we started, there's not a lot of it that's not rotten. The 20,000 hours of saltwater work for a third level airline that had to get it flying the next morning because there were bookings don't bode too well for quality repairs and you know, corrosion prevention. But anyway, it's there, and it will eventually come out the door, I guess, one day.
Well, there we have it. There's a great little update from Warren about what's happening at Aspects, and there's always a lot of excellent projects happening here in New Zealand. So, yeah, keep an eye on the scene, and you can do that through, of course, the Wings Over New Zealand Aviation Forum, which everybody seems to watch from around the world. Actually, there was one piece of news that I forgot to mention before, which is going on right now. There's a film being made at the moment in New Zealand. I think it's a television film, and it's involving some classic aircraft, and that's really cool to see. It's the story of Jean Batten. And I don't know whether many people will remember Jean Batten. She's certainly remembered here in New Zealand, but she was an aviatrix who was a bit like America's Amelia Earhart or Britain's Amy Johnston. She used to fly solo around the world back in the 1930s. She was the first person to ever fly from all the way from Britain to New Zealand in 1936, and quite an amazing lady and quite a complex lady. She was quite a strange lady as well, very beautiful as well, and it's going to make a great film, I'm sure. And of course, some of the classic aircraft around the country have been repainted into her colors, and that's filming at the moment over at Thames Aerodrome, so we'll keep an eye out for that one. That's going to be great to see. And speaking of classic aircraft, Matt, I think there was something we were going to discuss. Now, what was it?
Yeah, I think you had flown in, was it a Piper Cub? No.
No, it wasn't a Cub. No, it was a Spitfire.
Oh, a Spitfire, yeah. Tell us about this, because this is quite the story, Dave.
It is quite the story. For the forum meet, I had very kindly been Doug Brooker very kindly agreed to speak at the forum meet, and he gave a great talk as well. But just before the event, he happened to say to me, "Oh, what are you doing this afternoon?" And I was thinking in my back of my head, "Well, obviously I'm doing the forum meet. I'm here doing this." And he said, "Oh, because I've got this fly pass, and I wondered if you wanted to hop in the back seat for it." And I was like, "What?" You know, I was having heart palpitations just thinking about it, and of course I said yes, and then I had to go and break the news to all of the people who were waiting there in the audience that we were going to slightly change the schedule that afternoon because I was going for a Spitfire ride, which I was very pleased to receive a rousing ovation from the crowd. I thought that was quite amazing. The Spitfire itself, and also how good is the timing? Because on the weekend, it was the 80th anniversary of the first flight of a Spitfire, the famous, the famous prototype in 1936. So, you know, what perfect timing, and you know, the Spitfire itself, Doug's is a TR9, which is the two-seat Spitfire. It was actually restored in the USA and came out to New Zealand in 2008. It's been flying here on the scene since. It's very famous and popular here in New Zealand on the air show scene. We've got three airworthy Spitfires in New Zealand now, but this is the only two-seater. And for at least a year or so, it's been maybe 2 years now, it's been doing rides as well. You can actually pay to fly in the back of it, and they get a lot of rides, particularly at air shows and things like that. But it's doing very well. When you approach the aircraft and you go to look in the back cockpit, it's a lot smaller and tighter than the front cockpit, and you really realize that when you get inside. I'd actually sat in the front of that aircraft once before, and it's got a standard front cockpit basically, but the rear cockpit is very tight, and particularly when you close the canopy. So that was quite amazing. Just impressions of the flight, the startup, something I'd never even considered or realized, but you know, the smoke from that startup comes straight into the cockpit and changes the atmosphere. It gets very hot all of a sudden, and it gets quite smelly, and you start to almost choke on the fumes for a couple of seconds until the prop wash starts to come through. And then, you know, you just feel that vibration of the aircraft and you're taxiing out, and it's just fantastic. It's incredible. The takeoff was just brilliant. The performance just felt amazing compared to anything else I've been in. Once you get airborne and you look out the both sides and you're looking at those elliptical wings, you know, passing over the green fields of South Auckland, it's just beautiful. I just couldn't believe I was there. I could not believe I was actually sitting in that thing, looking out at those elliptical wings and the big roundels on the wings. And it's a beautiful aircraft too. Those who haven't seen it, it's in the desert colours. It's in the colours of New Zealand's top ace, Colin Gray, who led 81 Squadron, and this is his 81 Squadron aircraft colours. It's got the codes FLA on the side. And back in 1993, I actually met and had a few beers with Colin Gray, and he told me some great stories, and he was a wonderful man. He's no longer with us. And, you know, to later on fly in an aircraft painted in his markings, just amazing. I also know a couple of guys who flew in the squadron with him, and some of you may remember that, was it last year? It was last year. We actually raised money on the Wings Over New Zealand Forum to get two of those Spitfire pilots up in that aircraft, Alan Peart and Jim Robinson, and they went and had their flights with Doug. And I think they flew with Gavin Trithewey, one of the other pilots. But it was just great to do that for them. And then suddenly I'm in the aircraft myself doing it as well, which is just incredible. We flew over up the coast to Auckland City, and flew over the city, and I was looking out across the cityscape, and we flew over things like Auckland Museum and Music Point, which most people won't even know what that's about, but it's a memorial to – there's a memorial there to Captain Music, who was a Pan Am Boeing Clipper captain who was killed in a crash in 1939 or 40. I can't remember the exact date. And then we – arrived at the Museum of Transport and Technology, MOTAT, where they were having a live day for military vehicles and reenactors and that sort of thing. And we did some very low, very tight turns over the museum. And that was the point where my stomach started to get a little bit queasy, because I'm not really good with aerobatics, and just those tight turns. The forces in that aircraft, fantastic. You know, those tight turns. And they always talk about nothing can outturn a Spitfire, and I can see exactly what they're talking about now, having been in that one, just turning like on a dime over the museum. And just marvellous. I mean, I've still got the grin on my face.
Well, I'm glad you got to go. I mean, that's the full immersion, and it couldn't have happened to a better guy, Dave. Congratulations on it. So what did they say when you landed? I mean, give me the idea of the reception.
It was interesting, because when I got back to where everyone was at the forum meet, there was a lot of people with huge smiles on their faces and couple came up and shook my hand, and then one of the guys came up and gave a huge hug, and then a couple others came up and hugged me, and it's like it was almost like I was some sort of, you know, special pilot who'd flown from the other side of the world, like Gene Batten that I was talking about earlier. It was, but it was just incredible. Everyone was so happy for me, and they just thought it was marvelous. And Stu Russell that I mentioned earlier, he got some great photos, which I'm really, really pleased with. I don't normally like being photographed, but he got some great photos of me in the aircraft. And yeah, I'm so grateful to everyone who, and the way that they reacted, it was marvelous. And you know, I just want to say again to Doug, thank you so much for that opportunity. I've spent a long time, many years interviewing veterans, and I've met and got to know a number of Spitfire pilots from World War II. And I know a number of guys in the Warbirds now who fly Spitfires. And to me, all of them are heroes. They're all, you know, right up there among the top. To be able to have the opportunity to feel those kind of things that they felt in that aircraft, and the sensations, the atmosphere, the smells, you know, that vibration, the stomach churning tight turns, I now feel so much more connected to the stories that they've told me over the years, and it's just wonderful. It really is.
Oh, well said, and great show tonight, Dave. Unfortunately, it's that time. It's that time again.
Already.
It's already here.
It's a good thing that Grant's not on, because we wouldn't have had any time for him anyway.
Great fun, though.
Well, thanks, Matt. Thank you very much.